Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Bhutang dhammang sanghang namassami. So the sutta today is number 60, the Apanaka Sutta, the incontrovertible teaching. Somebody, I think it was Hugh Sykes, gave me a list of the suttas which I have not covered yet, and so I'm trying to go through those. There is a good reason why they have not been covered before. One of those reasons is they're not really very interesting. Another reason is they're really short, and it takes a lot of padding to make such a short sutta interesting for people to come here on a Sunday afternoon. Or the last reason, which applies to this sutta, is they're extremely long. So this is one of the longest ones in this collection, but nevertheless I'll read it out. And because it's so long, I'm flagging a rule today that no one is allowed to ask more than three questions. Three questions is maximum. And it's your job, Venerable Dharakita, to see who does the fourth question. You give them a red card and they have to... Because otherwise, so if you have a question, please choose it carefully. You've only got three. So that's also a reason why I'm starting straight on time, because we don't have really much time to waste. So this is the incontrovertible teaching. It's one of those suttas where the Buddha is talking mostly about the theory of existence. But of course it does have great ramifications to your practice. And in particular, set in the time of the Buddha, where there was many philosophers, practitioners, who said all sorts of things, and especially about whether it's reincarnation or not reincarnation, a heaven realm which is permanent or a heaven realm or reincarnation which is temporary, whether there was such a thing as karma or not karma, and also the nature of nibbana. And the Buddha is answering these questions in a way that says, well, look, you might as well believe in this way because it's in your interest, whichever way it turns out. So it's a practical application of these beliefs rather than a philosophical application of the beliefs. And afterwards, at the very, very end, the Buddha goes into the practice. It's abbreviated in this sutta, the gradual training, but we'll get to that when we come to it. So here we go, the Apanaka Sutta, the incontrovertible teaching. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was wandering in the Kosalan country with a large sangha of monks, and eventually arrived at a Kosalan Brahmin village named Sala. Kosala was one of the biggest kingdoms in India at the time, centered at Sarvati. And this particular village, according to the commentary, lived on the edge of the forest. And because it was on the edge of the forest, according to the commentary, which makes a lot of sense, there were many monks and practitioners, meditators, would actually come through that town and then go off into the forest to meditate. So it was a very a city which had many, many people visiting. Then the Brahmin householders of Sala heard, the recluse Gotama, the Buddha, the son of the Sakyans, who went forth from a Sakyan clan, has been wandering in the coastal and country with a large sangha of bhikkhus and has come to Sala. Now a good report of Master Gotama has been spread to this effect. I'm going to say this in Pali. Itipiso bhagava alahang samma sambuddho vija charana sampano sugato lokavidu nutaro purisa dhamma sarati sata deva manusano buddho bhagavati. This is what you chant. And this is actually not something made up. This is what you see in many suttas here. The Buddha, the Blessed One, is accomplished, fully enlightened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, sublime knower of the worlds. That means the three worlds, not just the world of the five senses, but also the jhana realms and immaterial realms. As a teacher of gods and humans, sometimes when some people tell me that your Buddha is nobody, I say, well, it's a teacher of your God. Enlightened and blessed. He declares the world with its gods, its maras and its brahmas, and so he knows all these. This generation with its recluses and brahmins, its princes and people, which he has himself realized with direct knowledge. Realizing with direct knowledge means it's not a theory. The fellow knows what he's talking about. And he teaches the Dhamma Good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end. With the right meaning and phrasing, and he reveals a holy life that is utterly perfect and pure. In other words, it's not just a teaching which you have to believe, it's a holy life which you can practice and attain. Now it is good to see such arahats. Then the Brahmin householders of Sala went to the Blessed One. Some paid homage to the Blessed One and sat down on one side. Those were the disciples. Some exchanged greetings with him, and when his courteous and able talk was finished, sat down on one side. These ones who respected him weren't disciples. Some extended their hands in reverential salutation towards the Blessed One and sat down on one side. In other words, they were just being courteous but not very respectful. And some pronounced their name and clan in the Blessed One's presence and sat down at one side. And some simply kept silent and sat down at one side. And all the different levels of respect which were there at the time. When they were seated, the Blessed One asked them, "Householders, is there any teacher agreeable to you in whom you have acquired faith supported by reasons?" So, of all the teachers who'd come through, is there any there which you really, really believe in? "No, venerable sir, there is no teacher agreeable to us whom we have acquired faith supported by reasons." And they say the reason is that every time a new teacher came in, they just blasted the teacher who went before them, so tearing down those teachings, and so they were totally confused. And it's very easy to be negative and tear down somebody else's teachings, and that means people get confused. "Since, householder, you have not found an agreeable teacher, you may undertake and practice this incontrovertible teaching. For when the incontrovertible teaching is accepted and undertaken, it would lead to your welfare and happiness for a long time." And what is this incontrovertible teaching? So it's going to lead to your welfare and happiness for a long time. So it's split into five parts, and the first one is the doctrine of nihilism. That's what Bhikkhu Bodhi calls it here. And this is basically the doctrine that when you die, there is nothing left. No reincarnation, no rebirth, as you will soon see in a few moments. No rebirth. Now, in Pali, the idea of rebirth is expressed in the idea of another world. In other words, another world where you can take rebirth into. So where it says here, yes, there is another world, this means the truth of rebirth. When they say, no, there's no other world, it means no rebirth. "Householder, there are some recluses and Brahmins, some religious teachers, whose doctrine and view is this. There is nothing given, nothing offered, nothing sacrificed, no fruit or result of good and bad deeds." In other words, no karma because there's no rebirth. "There is no this world, no other world, no father, no mother." This means that just looking after your mum and dad don't have any real effect. "No beings who are reborn spontaneously." This is in heaven realms. "No good and virtuous recluses and Brahmins in this world who have themselves realized by direct knowledge and declare this world and the other world." So the last part here, that there's no people who actually have direct knowledge of this. Maybe that people believe in it, but you know, how do you know? "Now there are some recluses and Brahmins whose doctrine is directly opposed to that of those recluses and Brahmins. And they say thus, there is what is given and what is offered and what is sacrificed." No, it does have results in a future life. "There is fruit and result of good and bad karma. There is this world and there is the other world. There is mother and father. Looking after them will give you good rebirth. There are beings who are reborn spontaneously." When a person arises in the heaven realm, then they don't get born in a womb, they don't wear nappies, they don't go to school, they're not kids, they're born totally mature. So there are beings who are reborn spontaneously. "There are good and virtuous recluses and Brahmins in the world who have themselves realized by direct knowledge and declare this world and the future world, the other world, after death. What do you think, householders? Don't these recluses and Brahmins hold doctrines directly opposed to each other?" "Yes, venerable sir." So it's just basically to to make it quite concise, rebirth or no rebirth. Now, householders, of those recluses and Brahmins whose doctrine and view is this, there is nothing given, no good and virtuous recluses and Brahmins in the world who have themselves realized by direct knowledge and declare this world and the other world. It is to be expected of those who don't believe in reincarnation that they will avoid these three wholesome states, namely good bodily conduct, verbal conduct, and mental conduct. And they will undertake and practice the three unwholesome states, namely bodily misconduct, verbal misconduct, and mental misconduct. Why is that? Because those good recluses and Brahmins do not see in unwholesome states the danger, degradation, and defilement, nor do they see in wholesome states the blessings of renunciation, the aspect of cleansing. In other words, if there is no reincarnation, if you can cheat, fornicate, steal, kill, as long as you can get away with it, what's the difference? In other words, now we all die anyway, so live, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we all die, all the same. Now, paragraph 8. Since there actually is another world, here is one of the statements where the Buddha is actually saying quite specifically there is reincarnation. Let's need to mention that because sometimes people say, where in the suttas does the Buddha actually say that there is reincarnation? Or is it just some strategy or just some belief or just some cultural aspect of Buddhism? Here we see the Buddha actually saying there actually is reincarnation. The one who holds the view there is no other world has wrong view. Since there actually is reincarnation, I'm going to put reincarnation instead of another world because that's what it really means. One who intends there is no reincarnation is wrong intention. Since there actually is another world, one who makes the statement there is no reincarnation has wrong speech. They're deceiving. Since there actually is reincarnation, one who says there is no reincarnation is opposed to those arahats, enlightened ones, who know reincarnation. Since there actually is another world, one who convinces another there is no reincarnation convinces him to accept an untrue Dhamma. And because he convinces another to accept a Dhamma which is untrue, he praises himself, disparages others. Thus any pure virtue that he formerly had is abandoned and corrupt conduct, is substituted. And this wrong view, wrong intention, wrong speech, opposition to noble ones who know there is reincarnation, convincing another to accept an untrue Dhamma, and self-praise and disparagement of others, these several evil, unwholesome states thus come into being with a wrong view as their condition. Paragraph 9. About this, a wise person considers thus. If there is no reincarnation, then on the dissolution of the body, this good person would have made himself safe enough. In other words, so if there is no reincarnation, the person who does evil deeds, well, what does it really matter? But if there is reincarnation, then on the dissolution of the body after death, that scallywag will reappear in a state of deprivation, in an unhappy destination, in perdition, even in hell. Now, whether or not the word of those good recluses and Brahmins is true, let me assume that there is no other world and no reincarnation. Still, this good person is here and now. Still, they always call them good persons. The good person who was a scallywag. So still, this scallywag is here and now censured by the wise as an immoral person, one of wrong view who holds the doctrine of no rebirth. But on the other hand, if there is another world, then this good person has made an unlucky throw on both counts, since he is censured by the wise here and now, and on the dissolution of the body after death, he will reappear in a state of deprivation, an unhappy destination in perdition, even in hell. He has wrongly accepted and undertaken this incontrovertible teaching in such a way that it extends only to one side and includes the wholesome alternatives. The argument there being, if there is no reincarnation, then being a good person, at least you get praised by people. You're a moral person. And if there's no reincarnation, then at least you've got sort of one wholesome alternative. You've done a good life and people praise you and respect you for that. But if there is reincarnation, then obviously you win both ways if you're a good person. If there is no reincarnation, the scallywag gets treated as an immoral person and blamed. And if there is reincarnation, Iskariya Wak not only gets blamed, but he also goes to a lower realm after he dies. Or she dies. It can't be gender specific. The Iskariya Waks are of both genders, as you all know. And that is why they call it an incontrovertible teaching. In other words, it's best to assume, or maybe there is, maybe reincarnation, and actually to do wholesome acts of body, speech, and mind. Now, B. Now, householders, of those recluses and Brahmins whose doctrine and view is this, there is what is given. There are good and virtuous recluses and Brahmins in the world who have themselves realized by direct knowledge and declare this world and the other world. It is to be expected, if they believe in reincarnation, that they will avoid these three unwholesome states, namely bodily misconduct, verbal misconduct, and mental misconduct, and that they will undertake and practice these three wholesome states, namely good bodily conduct, good verbal conduct, and good mental conduct. Why is that? Because those good recluses and Brahmins see in unwholesome states the danger, degradation, and defilement. And they see in wholesome states the blessing of renunciation, the aspect of cleansing. In other words, reincarnation makes it even more important that you do good karma. And now, again, the Buddha said, B2, paragraph 11, since there actually is another world, one who holds the view there is another world has right view. Since there actually is another world, one who intends there is another world has right intention. I think what it means by intention means they practice, have an intention to make sure they have a good rebirth in such a next world. Since actually is another world, one who makes the statements, yes, there is reincarnation, has right speech, they're not misleading people. Since there actually is another world, one who says there is another world is not as opposed to those arahats who know that there is reincarnation. Since there actually is another world, one who convinces another there is another world or reincarnation convinces them to accept a true teaching. And because he convinces another to accept a true Dhamma, they do not praise themselves and disparage others. If it's a true Dhamma, it's beyond praise and blame. Usually that if it's a dodgy Dhamma, untrue, that's where people start to have conceit. I'm better than you, you're stupid. And there we get praise and blame from. Thus, any corrupt conduct that he formerly had is abandoned and pure virtue is substituted. And this right view, right intention, right speech, non-opposition to noble ones, convincing another to accept a true teaching and avoidance of self-praise and disparagement of others, these several wholesome states thus come into being with right view as their condition. About this, a wise man considers thus. If there is another world, reincarnation, then on the dissolution of the body after death, this good person will reappear in a happy destination, even in the heavenly world. Now, whether or not the word of those good recluses and Brahmins is true, in other words, I don't know yet, let me assume that there is reincarnation. Still, this good person here and now is praised by the wise as a virtuous person, one with right view who holds to the doctrine of affirmation. And on the other hand, if there is reincarnation, then this good person has made a lucky throw of the dice on both counts, since he is praised by the wise in this life, and since on the dissolution of the body after death, they will reappear in a happy destination, even in the heavenly world. They have rightly accepted and undertaken the incontrovertible teaching in such a way that it extends to both sides and it excludes the unwholesome alternative. So it's incontrovertible in the sense that the Buddha is actually saying there's reincarnation, but even if you don't believe in it, you know, just maybe take it on board. Because if you do, that will give you an extra incentive to live a good and virtuous life. People who believe there is no reincarnation, then sometimes the incentive to live a good and a virtuous life is missing. So if you don't believe in it, it means that you're more likely to live a bad life and thereby get praise. And if there is reincarnation, you're going to doubly lose and go to a bad rebirth. If you do believe in reincarnation, at least as a possibility, then it means you're the incentive to be a good person, to be kind, to be generous, to make good karma is much stronger. You will get praised by other people. And also, if there is reincarnation, you'll go to a heaven realm. If there's not, at least you get your praise. So the Buddha's actually saying the argument is it's worth to take it on board, because you win either way. Do you get it? Any questions on that so far? Yes. No, it's exactly the same. Sometimes people have a pedantic idea that reincarnation is reincarnation of a soul. And they say rebirth is the same process, but accepting there is no soul. In English language, though, that reincarnation means both. No, it does not. No, this is the point. No. Not in our local language. So that it's very true that there is a great difference between two ideas. One is with a soul, one is with an ever-changing stream of consciousness. However, in the English language, every person calls both of these reincarnation. So one is reincarnation with a permanent soul, one is reincarnation without a permanent soul. Now that particular difference was posited by some pedantic scholars a long time ago. But when we talk about rebirth, it doesn't really gel with people. They think, no, I thought you Buddhists believe in reincarnation. And it's much healthier and more useful to call it reincarnation and then just to make the additional comment that it is without a soul. Indeed, of course it is. So it's just we're just using just the language. The word as it's meant and understood by most Australians doesn't necessarily mean an eternal soul being reincarnated. So it is a word which was, it was an argument which was posed a long time ago, which I don't buy into. And it's much more useful as a teacher to call it reincarnation. That's what people understand. And when I talk about reincarnation, to also make the point that it's not a permanent soul which is being reincarnated. It's a stream of cause and effect. Any other questions there? Okay, let's go down to the second part here, which is the law of karma. You've got reincarnation, that's the law of karma, the doctrine of non-doing. Householder, there are some recklessness and Brahmins whose doctrine and view is this. When one acts or makes others act, remember karma, if you tell other people to do it, it's just about the same as doing it yourself. When one acts or makes others act, when one mutilates or makes others mutilate, when one tortures or makes others inflict torture, when one inflicts sorrow and makes others inflict sorrow, when one oppresses or makes others inflict oppression, when one intimidates or makes others inflict oppression, makes others inflict intimidation. When one kills living beings, takes what's not given, breaks into houses, plunders wealth, commits burglary, ambushes highways, seduces another's wife, utters falsehood, no evil is done by the doer. If with a razor-rimmed wheel one were to make the living beings on this earth into one mass of flesh, into one heap of flesh, you can imagine those times before special effects and movies that this idea would actually be quite interesting to people, because people always like horror movies. I don't know why. You look in the newspapers and many of those movies are trying to be gory and lots of blood and violence. But in those days before movies, they would come listen to the suttas. Into one mass of flesh. Because of this, there will be no evil and no outcome of evil. If one were to go along the south bank of the Ganges, killing and slaughtering, mutilating and making others mutilating, torturing and making others inflict torture, because of this, there will be no evil and no outcome of evil. If one were to go along the north bank of the Ganges, giving gifts and making others give gifts, making offerings and making others make offerings, because of this, there will be no merit and no outcome of merit. By giving, by taming oneself, by restraint, by speaking truth, there is no merit nor outcome of merit. In other words, there's no karma. In other words, whatever you do, there's no reward, no punishment for it. There's no sort of result of it. Do whatever you like, see if you can get away with it. Now, there are some recklessness and Brahmins whose doctrine is directly opposed to that of the recklessness and Brahmins, and they say thus, when one acts or makes others act, when one mutilates or makes others mutilate, utters falsehood, evil is done by the doer. If with a razor-rimmed wheel one were to make the living beings on this earth into one mass of flesh, into one heap of flesh, because of this there would be evil and outcome of evil. If one were to go along the south bank of the Ganges, killing and slaughtering, mutilating and making others mutilate, torturing and making others inflict torture. Because of this, there would be evil and the outcome of evil. If one were to go along the north bank of the Ganges giving gifts and making others give gifts, making offerings and making others make offerings, because of this, there would be merit and the outcome of merit. By giving, by taming oneself, by restraint, by speaking truth, there is merit and the outcome of merit. What do you think, householders? Don't these recluses and Brahmins hold doctrines directly opposite to each other? Yes, venerable sir. And just as a minor point here, you may notice that they always go along the south bank of the Ganges, killing and mutilating, and the north bank of the Ganges, actually giving gifts. So it'd be much nicer to live along the north bank of the Ganges than the south bank of the Ganges. And that's especially relevant because Kosala was on the north bank of the Ganges. So talking to the people on the north bank, sort of, if they were giving this sutta on the south bank, they would probably swish it around. But what they're really saying there is that so there's no real result of karma. Do what you like, it doesn't matter. Now, householders, if those recluses and Brahmins whose doctrine and view is this, when one acts or makes others act, there is no merit and no outcome of merit, it is to be expected they will avoid these three wholesome states, namely good bodily conduct, verbal conduct, and mental conduct. And they will undertake and practice these three unwholesome states, namely bodily misconduct, verbal and mental misconduct. Why is that? Because those good recluses and Brahmins do not see in unwholesome states the danger, degradation, and defilements, nor do they see in wholesome states the blessing of renunciation, the aspect of cleansing. What's the point of making good karma? There's no result, they think. Since there actually is this doing, this kriya, this law of karma, one who holds the view there is no karma has a wrong view. Since there actually is karma, one who intends there is no karma, or intends following that view, gets wrong intention. Since there actually is karma, one who makes a statement there is no karma has wrong speech. Since there actually is doing karma, one who says, ah, oh, there's no karma, they are opposed to those arahats who hold the doctrine that there is karma. Since there actually is karma, one who convinces other there is no karma, convinces them to accept an untrue dharma. And they will praise themselves and disparage others. Thus any pure virtue that they had formerly is abandoned, and corrupt conduct is substituted. And this wrong view, wrong intention, wrong speech, opposition to noble ones, convincing another to accept an untrue dharma, and self-praise and disparagement of others, these several evil, unwholesome states thus come into being with wrong view as their condition. About this, a wise man considers thus. If there is no karma, then on the dissolution of the body, this good person will have made himself safe enough. There's no karma after they die, they'll be the same as everybody else. The good people, the bad people all end up the same. There's no karma. But if there is karma, then on the dissolution of the body after death, that scallywag will reappear in a state of deprivation. And of course, they don't say scallywag there, I just add that in there just to make it quite clear. They will reappear in a state of deprivation, in an unhappy destination, in perdition, even in hell. Now, whether or not the word of those good recluses and Brahmins is true, let me assume there is no karma. Still, this good person is here and now censured by the wise as an immoral person, one of wrong view, who holds the doctrine of no karma. But on the other hand, if there is karma, then this good person has made an unlucky throw on both counts, since he is censured by the wise here and now, and on the dissolution of the body after death, he will appear in a state of deprivation, in an unhappy destination, in perdition, even in hell. He has wrongly accepted and undertaken this incontrovertible teaching in such a way that extends only to one side and excludes the wholesome alternative. Now, householders, of those recluses and Brahmins whose doctrine and view is this, when one acts or makes others act, there is merit, an outcome of merit, it is to be expected that they will avoid these three unwholesome states, namely bodily misconduct, verbal misconduct, and mental misconduct. And they will undertake and practice these three wholesome states, that is, good bodily, verbal, and mental conduct. Why is that? Because those good recluses and Brahmins see in unwholesome states the danger, degradation, and defilement. And they see in wholesome states the blessings of renunciation, the aspect of cleansing. Since there actually is doing, One who holds the view that is karma has right view. Since there actually is karma, one who intends there is karma has right intention. And all their intention is based on the law of karma. In other words, they intend to do good things. Since there actually is karma, one who makes a statement there is karma has right speech. Since there actually is karma, one who says there is karma is not opposed to those arahats who hold the doctrine that there is karma. Since there actually is karma, one who convinces others there is karma convinces them to accept a true Dhamma. And because they convince another to accept a true Dhamma, they don't go around praising themselves and disparaging others. Thus, any conduct that he formerly had is abandoned and pure virtue is substituted. And this right view, right intention, right speech, non-opposition to the noble ones, convincing another to accept the true Dhamma and avoidance of self-praise and disparaging of others, these several wholesome states thus come into being with right view as their condition. About this, a wise man considers thus. If there is karma, then on the dissolution of the body, after death, this good person will reappear in a happy destination, even in the heavenly realm. Now, whether or not the word of those good requisites and Brahmas is true, let me assume that there is no karma. Still, this good person is here and now praised by the wise as a virtuous person, one with right view who holds the doctrine of karma. And on the other hand, if there is karma, then this good person has made a lucky throw on both counts, since he is praised by the wise here and now in this life, and since on the dissolution of the body after death, he will appear in a happy destination, even the heavenly world. He has rightly accepted and undertaken his incontrovertible teaching in such a way that extends to both sides and excludes the unwholesome alternative. So that's sort of the argument which the Buddha is putting about the law of karma and rebirth. And it's a very decent teaching. If one doesn't believe in reincarnation, doesn't believe in karma, sometimes people do all sorts of immoral actions. Sometimes they will be a good people because they like being praised and looked upon as being virtuous. But I remember reading an article on ethics, and even Aristotle realized that you can't impose ethics on from above. You can't actually have laws on a society and tell people, yes, you know, you have to do this. You can't kill people, otherwise you'll be executed or go to jail. It has to come actually from within. You have to teach people to be ethical. And that idea of teaching people to be ethical, in this article they said that was a discovery of Aristotle. And of course these people had never understood just this type of teaching was there a long time beforehand in sort of Indian philosophy, that ethics can be taught and there can be reasoned. And this is the Buddha trying to teach ethics. Whether it's rebirth or it's not rebirth, no, it's in your interest still to be good. Karma or no results of karma, it's still in your interest to be good. Because, you know, if there is karma and rebirth, you know, you certainly win twice over. If there's not, at least you sort of get respect in this life for being a good person. And it's also where the Buddha actually does say, but there, since there is the law of karma, since there is reincarnation. So he's actually making it very clear. And many times when people talk about Buddhism, sometimes we may talk about sort of the higher stuff, but this is nitty-gritty, basic Buddhism, karma and rebirth. Any questions on this so far? Okay, let's go to the third major section on causality and non-causality. Householder, there are some recluses and Brahmins whose doctrine and view is this. There is no cause or condition for the defilement of beings. Beings are defiled without cause or condition. There is no cause or condition for the purification of beings. Beings are purified without cause and conditions. There is no power, no energy, no manly or womanly strength, no manly or womanly endurance. All beings, all living things, all creatures, all souls are without mastery, power and energy. Molded by destiny, circumstances and nature, they experience pleasure, pleasure and pain in the six classes. And it's almost like a destiny. In other words, this is meant to be. So you've got to cop it sweet sometimes, cop it sort of hard sometimes. Just nature of things is, it's all mapped out for you. It's always in God's plan or somebody else's plan. So you can't do anything about it. Now there are some recluses and Brahmins whose doctrine is directly opposed to that of those recluses and Brahmins, and they say this. There is a cause and condition for the defilement of beings. Beings are defiled owing to a cause and a condition. There is a cause and condition for the purifications of beings. Beings are purified owing to a cause and condition. There is power, there is energy, there is man and womanly strength and endurance. It is not the case that all beings, all living things, all creatures, all souls are without mastery, power and energy, or that moulded by destiny, circumstance and nature, they experience pleasure and pain in the six classes. What do you think, householders? Don't these recluses and Brahmins hold doctrines directly opposed to each other? Yes, Venerable Sir. Now, householders, of those recluses and Brahmins whose doctrine and view is this, there is no cause or condition for the defilement of beings. They experience pleasure and pain in the six classes. The six classes of pleasure and pain, if I remember them correctly, are bodily pleasure, bodily pain, and bodily neither pleasure nor pain, mental pleasure, mental pain, and mental neither pleasure nor pain. Six classes. They experience pain and pleasure in the six classes. It is not to be expected that they will avoid these three wholesome states. This is, I'll start this one again. A1. Just blow my nose. Now, householders, of those recluses and Brahmins whose doctrine and view is this, there is no cause or condition for the defilement of beings. They experience pleasure and pain in the six classes. It is to be expected that they will avoid these three wholesome states, namely good bodily, verbal and mental conduct, and that they will undertake and practice three unwholesome states, namely bodily and verbal and mental misconduct. Why is that? Because they do not see in unwholesome states the danger, degradation and defilement, nor do they see in the wholesome states the blessing of renunciation, the aspect of cleansing. They think whatever happens, they're going to be pleasure and pain in the six classes. It's all down to fate, so they don't even try. Since there actually is causality, one who holds the view there is no causality has wrong view. Since there actually is causality, one who intends following with the idea there is no causality gets wrong intentions. Since there actually is causality, one who makes the statement there is no causality has wrong speech. Since there actually is causality, one who says there is no causality is opposed to those arahats who hold the doctrine of causality. Since there actually is causality, one who convinces another there is no causality convinces them to accept an untrue dharma, and because they convince another to accept an untrue dharma, eventually they praise themselves and disparage others. Thus, any pure virtue that they formerly had is abandoned, and corrupt conduct is substituted. And this wrong view, wrong intention, wrong speech, opposition to noble ones, convincing another to accept an untrue dharma, and self-praise and disparagement of others, these several unwholesome states thus come into being with wrong view. There is no causality as their condition. About this, a wise person considers thus: if there is no causality, then on the dissolution of the body, this good person would have made himself safe enough. But if there is causality, then on dissolution of the body after death, they will appear in a state of deprivation and unhappy destination, in perdition, even in hell. Now, whether or not the word of those good recluses and Brahmins is true, let me assume that there is no causality. In other words, you couldn't have done anything about it anyway. Still, this good person is here and now censured by the wise as an immoral person, one of wrong view who holds the doctrine of non-causality. But on the other hand, if there is causality, then this good person has made an unlucky throw on both counts, since he is censured by the wise here and now, and on the dissolution of the body after death, they will reappear in a state of deprivation, in an unhappy destination, in perdition, even in hell. They have wrongly accepted and undertaken this incontrovertible teaching in such a way that it extends only to one side and excludes the wholesome alternative. Now, householders, of those recluses and Brahmins whose doctrine and view is this, there is cause and condition for the defilement of beings. They experience pleasure and pain in the six classes. It is to be expected they will avoid the three unwholesome states, namely bodily, verbal, and mental misconduct, and they will undertake and practice the three wholesome states, namely good bodily, verbal, and mental conduct. Why is that? Because those good recluses and Brahmins see in unwholesome states danger, degradation, and defilement, and they see in wholesome states the blessing of renunciation, aspect of cleansing. Now here again the Buddha says, since there actually is causality, in other words, you can make things happen, one who holds the view there is no is causality, they have right view. Since there actually is causality, one whose intention follows that idea, that they can do something, has the right intention. Since there actually is causality, one who makes a statement there is causality has the right speech. Since there actually is causality, one who says there is causality is not opposed to those arahats who hold the doctrine of causality. Since there actually is causality, one who convinces another there is causality convinces them to accept true Dhamma. And because they convince another to accept true Dhamma, they do not praise themselves and disparage others. Thus any corrupt conduct that they formerly had is abandoned and pure virtue is substituted. And this right view, right intention, right speech, non-opposition to noble ones, convincing another to accept a true teaching and avoidance of self-praise and disparagement of others, these several wholesome states thus come into being with right view as their condition. About this, the wise person considers thus. If there is causality on the dissolution of the body after death, this good person will reappear in a happy destination even in the heavenly world. Now, whether or not the word of those good records and the Brahmins is true, let me assume that there is no causality. Still, this good person is here and now praised by the wise as a virtuous person, one with right view who holds the doctrine of causality. And on the other hand, if there is causality, then this good person has made a lucky throw on both counts, since they are praised by the wise here and now. And since on the dissolution of the body after death, they will reappear in a happy destination, even in the heavenly world. They have rightly accepted and undertaken this incontrovertible teaching in such a way that it extends to both sides and excludes the unwholesome alternative. So there you go. That was the hardest part of this Apanika Sutta. It goes into great detail. The Buddha is following a logical argument there to try and convince people to actually have wholesome bodily speech, action, and thought. And thereby, understanding the law of causality, you can cause good things to happen, which underlies the law of karma, that there is a result of what you do, which also must eventually give one the understanding of reincarnation, so that the karma has a realm in which to play out. So, basic teachings of Buddhism. Karma, rebirth, and causality. Yeah. That's a very good thing. What determines when the results of karma actually come up? And the way that it is explained, and it makes a lot of sense to me as a practitioner, someone who has studied the mind, is that when you do a good act, you get an immediate result. The happiness when you've actually done some kind, generous act. You feel you get the first reward immediately. And you usually get the reward again throughout this life and in future lives. So one good act is just like a seed of a mango tree. Just one mango planted creates thousands of mangoes afterwards. So you don't. It's not just a one-to-one response. You know, one good act gives one good response. It's usually many thousand times over. And the same for actually bad karma as well. So if you do some sort of bad karma, it comes back to you many, many times. Not just, you know, eye for an eye. It's, you know, many, many eyes for the eye you took out. Fortunately, that's just the way it happens. And sometimes you wonder, well, why actually does bad karma come to you at that particular time? And there is a causality, a way you can actually encourage good karma to come to fruition, and a way that you can discourage bad karma to come to fruition. It seems to be that the mind, actually, if it's in a very good mood, it's a very positive mood, it can actually resonate with your previous good karma. It's in a sort of a state where it can actually bring up the good karma from the past. But if you're in a negative, bad mood, that can actually bring up more bad karma. It's as if the mind, like a radio receiver, if it's tuned into sort of bad stuff, brings up more bad stuff. But if it's tuned into, you know, high-minded stuff, it brings in more high-minded stuff. On meditation retreats, you know, I've told people, actually make use of some of your good karma. Each one of you have given donations, you've kept precepts, you've fed the monks and the nuns, you've done charitable works outside of Buddhism, you've looked after your kids, you've sacrificed yourself, you've done lots and lots and lots of really good karma. So remember it. Bring it up to your mind. Recall all that you've done, or at least some of what you've done. And by doing that, you're actually connecting to the good karma of the past. And you get some of the results of that good karma. You feel happy, you're energized, your mind becomes pure, and you can use that recollection of your past good karma as a platform to get into deeper states of meditation. That's why just recollecting on your good karma is a beautiful way of causing good results to come up. If you reflect on your bad karma, then the bad effects can come up, as you know it does. If you know what you did wrong, the stupid thing you done, the evil, cheating thing you did, if you start recollecting that, you resonate with that and you open up a channel for the karmic result of bad karma to come into your lives. Which is why that people who get into negativity, a lack of self-esteem, even depression, they're opening up sort of channels for bad karma to come to fruition. So there is a sense that you can guide some of, you know, the good karma and the bad karma which comes up in your life. There is a sense of causality here. It's not just this is fated to be. You can actually tweak it. And you can actually tweak it pretty well if you know the rules of the game. So, yeah, you can make good karma come up. Otherwise, sometimes something jogs your memory, sometimes you're in a similar situation and the bad karma comes to you. Or sometimes in a similar situation, the good karma comes to you. Yeah. Yeah. That's they say in Buddhism that that's one of the most serious of bad karmas, the killing your mother and father. And you can understand the reason why, because your mother and father sort of looked after you and cared for you. Again, this will be a generalization. If you, say, had a mother and father, say a father who was a paedophile and sexually abused you, and out of self-defense, you know, you killed them, that would be a totally different sort of scenario. But then the usual caring mother and father who looked after you, if for some reason you decided to kill them, then that would have a sort of a very bad karmic effect. And according to that particular story, that karma was just so strong, it had to come out sooner or later. But you know, because he was an arahat, you know, what would usually have really, really hurt and caused, you know, massive suffering for an ordinary person, it was just the body being beaten up for Moggallana. So a bit of physical pain, but very, very short. And just a remnant of what would have happened to him if he hadn't become enlightened. But still would have to come up. So I said you can tweak it, but you can't control it totally. Okay, this is gets now into more interesting stuff, because law of karma and rebirth is nice, but the immaterial realms and the cessation of being. Now this is really what gets into nice deep stuff. Obviously that these people had in Sala, they'd actually heard sort of recluses and Brahmins come and talk about these immaterial realms and jhanas and stuff. So they're asking about this as well. Householder, there are some recluses and Brahmins, some teachers, whose doctrine and view is this. There are definitely no immaterial realms. The immaterial realms, this is actually based on the four immaterial jhanas. These are worlds made of perception. Now you can imagine just the finest part of the mind where again the body has disappeared, just a pure mind state, just based on perception, that the stream of consciousness can actually take rebirth in such a place. In other words, that perception is enough to sustain the process of the mind. For such a subtle place, it can stay there for eons. Householder, there are some recluses and Brahmins whose doctrine and view is this. There are definitely no immaterial realms. Now, there are some recluses and Brahmins whose doctrine is directly opposed to that of those recluses and Brahmins. And they say thus, there definitely are immaterial realms. What do you think, householders? Don't these recluses and Brahmins hold doctrines directly opposed to each other? Yes, Venerable Sir. About this, a wise person considers us. These good recluses and Brahmins hold the doctrine and view there are definitely no immaterial realms. But that hasn't been seen by me. And there are other good recluses and Brahmins hold the doctrine and view there definitely are immaterial realms. And that has not been known by me. Basically, I don't know either way. If without knowing and seeing, I were to take one side and declare only this is true, anything else is wrong, that would not be fitting for me. So in other words, if you don't know, so be the agnostic. I don't know, maybe wait and see. Now, as to the recluses and Brahmins who hold the doctrine of view that definitely are no material realms, if their word is true, then it is certainly possible that I may reappear after death among the gods of the five material realm who consist of mind. These are the jhana realms. Now, for those of you who I mentioned, the Buddha knows the three worlds, or knower of the worlds, and knower of the three worlds. There is this realm, human beings, animals, ghosts are included, the hell realms, the deva realms. These are all realms in what we call the karma loka, the five senses. These beings have five senses, as well as the mind. And when those five senses are abandoned, let go of, which is what you do in deep meditation, then you go to the world of the mind. Two worlds, one which is made of mind, the other one which is made of perception. The mind-made realm is the jhanas, the perception-made realm is the immaterial planes. So they're saying here that those are the three worlds. But as to recluses and Brahmins, if there definitely are immaterial realms, if their word is true, then it is certainly still possible I might reappear after death among the gods of the five material realms who consist of mind. That's the jhana realms. They may not be immaterial realms, but this is the jhana realms. But as to the recluses and Brahmins who hold the doctrine of view there definitely are immaterial realms, if their word is true, then it is certainly possible I might reappear after death among the gods of the immaterial realms who consist of perception. So, no, it doesn't really matter. The taking up of rods and weapons, quarrels, brawls, disputes, recrimination, malice and forced speech are seen to occur based on material form. You can't have sort of rods and weapons in the immaterial realms. But this does not exist at all in immaterial realms. After reflecting thus, he practiced a way to dispassion towards material forms, to the fading away and cessation of material forms. In other words, the body and things. You got a question? Yeah. It's number two. No, they're called sometimes fine material realm. So it's basically not material, but sometimes can appear as a material realm. Okay, it's impossible to think of it. It's yeah. It is, yeah. Sometimes it's almost as if there is an object there to experience rather than just a rather than a perception itself.
Is that a good translation?
It's not a good translation. There isn't a good translation. Which is why that because the Western world has had very little experience at all with meditative states, they have not developed the language. You can see the technological language, which is, say, on the internet or in physics or in science, is very, very well developed. But the language of the mind is just hardly developed at all in the West, which is, you know, we haven't got a word for jhana, we haven't got a word for some of the incredible states you can get into. And so that's one of the problems, though, with our language. Fine material, what is it? Arupa. No, that's not that. Arupa is immaterial. It is Rupa Loka, yes. That's right, Rupa Loka, just they call that fine material, which is a dodgy translation.
It's quite important to understand the karma and
The only reason why this was probably there was that they probably had other teachers talking about that before. That's the only reason which makes sense. Otherwise you'd think, where the heck is the so-called five material realms, the jhana realms? That's totally missing. At least you think you'd see that in here. So remember, these teachings were to people in a place at a time. They weren't supposed to be like essays which were supposed to cover every possible angle of Buddhism. This was actually talking to a person who asked a question. So because of that, one can infer that other teachers had been through that area before, talking about immaterial realms. And so the Buddha was answering them in the same way that they had been there before, talking about karma and reincarnation and causality. If you look at some of the different teachers who were there at the time of the Buddha, he was referring to the main teachers at that time. And of course, a couple of those teachers, Alara Kalama and Uddaka Ramaputta, they were talking about the immaterial realms. So it may be some of those disciples had been through there about the immaterial realms, and they said, do such things exist or do they not exist? We don't know. So I think it's specific to just the time and place. Now, the most important part of this teaching, I think anyway, cessation of existence, cessation of being. And that actually is a very accurate translation of bhava nirodha, the cessation of being. Householders. There are some recluses and Brahmins whose doctrine and view is this: there is definitely no cessation of being. In other words, that you will continue to exist forever and ever and ever, in some sort of way, in some heaven realm, in some sort of quasi-real realm, like the realm of the original mind, or the ground of all being, or the ineffable oneness of everything, so that you don't actually cease existence, but you carry on in some form or another. There is definitely no cessation of being. Now, there are some recluses and Brahmins whose doctrine is directly opposed to that of those recluses and Brahmins. And they say this: there definitely is a cessation of being. What do you think, householders? Don't these recluses and Brahmins hold doctrines directly opposed to each other? Yes, Venerable Sir. About this, a wise man considers thus: these good recluses and Brahmins hold the doctrine and view there is definitely no cessation of being. That has not been seen by me. And these other good recluses and Brahmins hold the doctrine and view there definitely is a cessation of being, but that has not been known to me. If without knowing and seeing I were to take one side and declare only this is true, anything else is wrong, that would not be fitting for me. So that's the first thing. Now, sometimes you may think, oh, it makes a lot of sense because this monk said that monk says that, but you don't know. Now, as the recluses and Brahmins who hold the doctrine of view there definitely is no cessation of being, if their word is true, then it is certainly still possible that I might appear after death amongst the god of the immaterial realms who consist of perception, because that's the highest form of being. They've just find perception. Perception is, what is it, of unlimited space, of unbound consciousness, perceptions of nothing, perceptions of neither perception or non-perception. You can't get more refined than that. That's the highest. So if there's no actual cessation, at least I'll get to the highest if I keep practicing. But as the recluses and Brahmins who hold the doctrine view that definitely is a cessation of being, if their word is true, then it is possible that I might, in this very life, attain final nibbana. So number one, you can see that cessation of being is nibbana. The view of those good recluses and Brahmins who hold the doctrine view that definitely is no cessation of being, they hold a view that definitely is no cessation of being. In other words, an original mind, a ground of all being, a sort of emerging into the oneness of everything. That view is close to lust, close to bondage, close to delighting, close to holding, close to clinging. But the view of those good recluses and Brahmins who hold a doctrinal view that definitely is cessation of being is close to non-lust, non-bondage, close to non-delighting, close to non-holding, close to non-clinging. In other words, it's more letting go. It's more abandoning. After reflecting thus, they practice the way to dispassion towards being, to the fading away and cessation of being. In other words, they can become enlightened. Any questions about that one? Yes. No, it's based on equanimity, on the equanimity of the fourth jhana. But this is where the mind, first of all, in these meditative attainments, the body disappears. So there's no feeling of the body, no seeing, no smelling, no tasting, no touching, no hearing. And we're just in the realm of the mind. And in the jhanas, there is the bliss, and finally gets into this beautiful equanimity of the fourth jhana. And then, so the body has disappeared with its five senses. In the second jhana, the will has disappeared. And now what's happening is, you know, the pleasure and pain have disappeared to get into the fourth jhana. And then the mind itself, consciousness starts to disappear. So how consciousness disappears, the object of consciousness becomes more and more refined. And as the object, what you're looking, gets more and more refined, the consciousness itself gets more and more refined. That which we call consciousness is very dependent upon what it's looking at. The more coarse the object of your consciousness, the more coarse your consciousness is. So as the object of your mind becomes more and more refined, so does the consciousness. And so you go into these stages of basically the mind sort of disappearing, fading away. Of no space, of basically no consciousness in the second immaterial realm. And so there's nothing left, and nothing becomes the object. So the consciousness, which is just looking at nothing, is incredibly refined until that nothingness disappears. And then if you look at it from this direction, from the observer, as it were, you're perceiving, but the other direction you're perceiving no perception. Which is why they say that last state of neither perception or non-perception, that just depends upon which side you look at it from. From this side of the observer, you're perceiving no perception. On the other side, no perception is your object. The mind is almost turned off. And of course, after that, the mind totally turns off, and that's cessation of perception and feeling here and now. Turns on again afterwards in the jhanas, but at nibbana it just finishes totally. Does that answer your question? No, this is the immaterial. The sometimes they call it the eighth jhana. It's the fourth immaterial attainment. But it's nice to the Buddha actually go from karma and reincarnation and causality. Causality, you know, to some very fine stuff about the cessation of existence, nibbana. You gonna cash in your chips? Your last one. Sorry. There's just no, not really. Is it? That's a very good point, because as you've heard me say before, when I started teaching, I started wondering how deep should I teach the lay community, can they really understand or accept this? And many monks say, well, you shouldn't teach jhanas, you shouldn't teach all this stuff to lay people. But you can see, in the time of the Buddha, Buddha taught everything. And so when I hear monks saying that, I think, no, you're not sort of following the way the Buddha followed. You're not following the way the Buddha taught. The Buddha sort of, he said he taught with an open hand, not with a closed fist. He never kept anything back from people. And of course, when you teach like this, as many lay people actually do practice and do, you know, become stream winners and anagamis and get jhanas and stuff, so which is brilliant. It actually happens. So because of that, and I say, yeah, let's just, you know, teach everything and let people actually see what Buddhism truly is and don't keep anything back. I think somebody told me, I forget who it was, in the Vietnamese tradition about, I don't know how many years ago, 50, 60 years ago or something, that they decided not to teach jhana to the lay community. They made a little ruling over there because they thought it was just too troublesome to teach jhana to the lay community. But I think they reversed that by now. But that's what I heard. It may not be true or not. I might get the details wrong. But I can actually see that there can be that tendency amongst monastics to say, just how can you understand this? And I think that's quite demeaning to the intelligence of the people who feed you every day. Yes, Jen. Okay, she wants to transfer one of her chips to you. Yeah, of course you can. Because actually we're going quite well. This is a long sutta and you've been quite quiet, which is very good. The last part of this is just an abbreviation of a previous sutta about the four kinds of persons. Now this is also including another type of teaching which would have gone through that area of the time, which is the ascetics. And that was especially the Jain tradition, which at the time of the Buddha, the two most popular traditions were the Jains and the Buddha. And it was one of those quirks of history that these two major world religions had their founders at the same time in the same place. For those of you who have been on pilgrimage to India, just know within, was it about 10 or 15 miles from the Vulture's Peak, that's Nalanda, and that was where Mahavira, the founder of the Jains, was born. So actually Mahavira was born in the same town as Sariputta, around the same time. So they met each other, they were there at the same time in the same place, and both of them founded great sort of religions, which are still strong to this day, the Jain tradition and the Buddhist tradition. It does seem, as many commentators say, that at the time of the Buddha, the Jain tradition was actually stronger. But later on, the Buddhist tradition became, obviously, worldwide and much stronger. But it's interesting that that was there at the same time. And the Jain tradition was very ascetic. So here they would have had the Jains through the town of Salo as well. So here the Buddha teaches the four kinds of persons. Householders. There are four kinds of persons to be found existing in the world. What for? Here a certain kind of person torments himself and pursues the practice of torturing himself. Here a certain kind of person torments others and pursues the practice of torturing others. Here a certain kind of person torments himself and pursues the practice of torturing himself and also torments others and pursues the practice of tormenting others. And here a certain kind of person does not torment himself or pursue the practice of torturing himself, nor do they torment others and pursue the practice of torturing others. And since they neither torment themselves nor others, they, in this very life, are hungerless, extinguished and cooled, and they abide experience bliss, having themselves become holy. The four types of persons. Number one, what kind of person, householders, torments themselves and pursues the practice of torturing themselves? And since we've got time, we can read all this stuff out, because sometimes people are interested in what people used to do. Here a certain person goes naked, rejecting conventions, licking his hands instead of washing them, not coming when asked. In other words, they are invited for food. No, they won't come. They're not stopping to take food when asked. They don't accept food brought to the monastery or food specially made or an invitation to a meal at a house. They receive nothing from a pot, from a bowl, across a threshold, in other words, from someone inside of the house when you're outside the house, across a stick, across a pestle, from two eating together, from a pregnant woman, from a woman giving suck, from a woman lying with a man, from where food is advertised to be distributed, from where a dog is waiting to be fed, from where flies are buzzing to eat something. You accept no fish or meat, vegetarian, drink no liquor, wine or fermented brew. So now this is what they say being really ascetic. I'm not really saying that not taking liquor and wine or fermented brew is being too ascetic. I think you should all do that. But what it was is just a whole list of doing nothing whatsoever. You keep to one house, to one morsel a day, keep to two houses, two morsels a day, or seven houses and several morsels a day. You live on one sourceful food a day, or two sourcefuls a day, or seven sourcefuls a day. You take food once a day, once every 2 days, once every 7 days. In other words, you fast, and so on into once every fortnight. You dwell pursuing the practice of taking food at stated intervals. You eat only greens, or millet, or wild rice, or hide parings, or moss, or rice spam, or rice scum, or sesame flour, or grouse, or even cow dung. That's pretty tough. You live on forest roots and fruits, feed on only fallen fruits. In other words, you don't pick them from the trees, only fallen ones. You clothe yourself in hemp mixed cloth, in the shrouds, in refuse rags, in tree bark, in antelope hide, in strips of antelope hide, in kusa grass fabric, which is very sharp and can cut you, in bark fabric, in wood shaving, in head hair wool, in animal wool, in owl's wings. I always wanted to see someone dressed in owl's wings. Really, really cool. But apparently that was what people used to do. He's one who pulls out his hair and beard instead of shaving it. You know, it's actually, we actually shave, we don't actually pluck it out. The one who stands continuously, they don't sit down. The one who squats continuously, devoted to maintaining the squatting position. The one who uses a mattress of spikes. You know, just like they do in India these days, the fakirs, the mattress of spikes. So this is actually a very old tradition. He makes a mattress of spikes, his bed. They dwell pursuing the practice of bathing in water 3 times daily, including the evening. That's really fascinating. That was considered to be ascetic in those days. You ask, you know, a kid, and they would say, yeah, I understand that having a shower every day or 3 times a day is ascetic. At least asking an English kid. Thus, in such a variety of ways, they dwell pursuing the practice of tormenting and mortifying the body. This is called the kind of person who torments himself, pursues the practice of torturing himself. In other words, these are the ascetics. And of course, the history is laden with people who follow just such severe ascetic practices. And the Jains were pretty good at it, but in the Middle Ages, some of the Christians, they really got the prize for asceticism. Because they used to have these Simon the Stylite, I always remember. Because you know these old columns they had, you know, the old Grecian columns, Roman columns, after all these wars, had these like really tall columns. And these guys would actually climb up it and actually sit and live on the top there. So no roof, no sort of cover from the wind or the rain. They couldn't have really slept because they can't lay down, not big enough for laying down. They're just on the top of these columns. And this one guy, Simon Stylite, because he's on top of the column, would never wash. And apparently just under his belt, the skin was rotting. And there was maggots underneath it. And every now he would shake the maggots off and they'd fall down below. And people would actually feed them and he'd actually get the food up in a basket and feed himself. And you know, from the top of his column, his high perch, you know, he'd shout advice to people. And because that was really, really ascetic, people thought he was very, very wise. And many other people followed them. And obviously the Christian bishops and stuff, they really thought these guys were absolutely crazy. And there's probably something very psychotic about them. You know, if they had sort of modern psychologists, they would have probably been put away in Greylands or Bentley or somewhere. But in those days, you know, they couldn't really tell the difference between like craziness and wisdom. Maybe even these days they can't tell the difference as well. But in those days, ascetic people, you know, we're given this idea of authority. So he said, that's someone who torments themselves. And of course, you all know that the Buddha taught the middle way, do not torment yourself. What kind of person, householders, torments others and pursues the practice of torturing others? Here a certain person is a butcher of sheep. Where does he go? A butcher of pigs, a fowler, a trapper of wild beasts, a hunter, a fisherman, a thief, an executioner, a prison warden. Now, I know many prison wardens in our Buddhist society. The reason why prison warden was supposed to be a bad livelihood in those days, because those prison wardens would actually torture people. That was part of their job description. So in these days, I don't think prison wardens do that. So I know many prison wardens, and they're really nice people. So because of the nature of the job in those days, it was considered someone who tortures themselves and tortures others. These days, I don't think it's the case. Or one who follows any other such bloody occupation. That is called the kind of person who torments others and pursues the practice of torturing others. Now, what person does both? And they give just an example in the text of what they used to do in the ancient days to make sure your kingdom runs well. This is the sort of thing which Kevin Rudd would have done, actually to make sure he didn't get deposed if he was living in India 2,500 years ago. Here some person is a head anointed prime minister or a well-to-do Brahmin, having had a new sacrificial temple built to the east of Canberra and having shaved off his hair and beard, dressing himself in rough hide, just making it interesting for you, and greased his body with ghee and oil, scratching his back with a deer horn, he enters a sacrificial temple together with his chief queen and his Brahmin high priest. There he lies down on the bare ground with grass on it. The king lives on the milk in the first teat of a cow with a calf of the same color, while the chief queen lives on the milk in the second teat, and the Brahmin high priest lives on the milk in the third teat. The milk in the fourth teat they pour onto the fire, and the calf lives on what is left, poor cow. He says thus, let so many bulls be slaughtered for sacrifice, let so many bullocks be slaughtered for sacrifice, so many heifers, goats, sheep, let so many trees be cut for the sacrificial post, let so much grass be cut for the sacrificial grass. And then their slaves, messengers and servants make preparation, weeping with tearful faces, being spurred on by threats of punishment and fear. If you don't do this, you know, we might kill you. This is a kind of person who torments himself and pursues the practice of tormenting himself and others, and pursues the practice of torturing himself and others. Now, before we go on to the person who neither torments himself nor torments others, which is the gradual path of training, you can see that Buddhism does not condone harming yourself or harming others. And of course, those are extremes of harming yourself and harming others, but there's many other gradations of self-harm. You know, not giving yourself a rest. You know, being too unkind to yourself. Now, I have a cold now. When I go back to monastery this evening, I'm going to get a good rest. I'm not into torturing myself or forcing myself. But if you do that, it just gets worse. And it's also not into torturing others. So I'm not going to let this sutta go on too long today. So this is actually how we're kind to ourselves and kind to others. But the best way of doing that is the gradual path. And here we go. It's a very long one, but I think I'll do this in 10 or 15 minutes. Here, householders, a Buddha appears in the world. Accomplished, fully enlightened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, sublime, knower of worlds, incomparable leader of persons to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, enlightened, blessed, as we said before. And a householder or householder's son or daughter or one born into some other clan hears the teaching of the Buddha. On hearing the Dhamma, they acquire faith in Buddhism. Possessed of that faith, they consider thus. A household life is crowded and dusty. Life gone forth is wide open. It's not easy while living at home to lead the holy life, utterly perfect and pure as a polished shell, especially the conch shells, which they used to use for summoning people. Suppose I shave off my hair and beard, so most people had beards in those days, put on the yellow robe and go forth from home life into homelessness. On a later occasion, abandoning a small or large fortune, or a large circle, small or large circle of relations, they shave off their hair and beard, put on the yellow robe and go forth from the home life into homelessness, they ordain. Having thus gone forth and possessing the monks and nuns' way of training and way of life, they abandon all the wrong things. And this is interesting. This is almost like a very early form of the monk's training. This is what monks aren't supposed to do. So listen to this. It's really important. They abandon the killing of living beings. They abstain from killing of living beings. With rod and weapon laid aside, gentle and kindly, they abide compassionate to all living beings. It's much more than just not killing. It's actually looking after the animals in your monastery or in your environment. They abandoning the taking of what's not given. They abstain from taking what's not given. They take only what is given to them. They expect only what's given. They don't think, oh, may they give this, may they give that. What they're given is all they expect. By not stealing, they abide in purity. Abandoning in celibacy, they observe celibacy, living apart from the opposite gender. Living apart is important. Abandoning from the vulgar practice of sexual intercourse. Abandoning false speech. They abstain from false speech. They speak the truth. They adhere to truth. They're trustworthy and reliable. One is no deceiver of the world. Abandoning malicious speech. They abstain from malicious speech. They do not repeat elsewhere what they have heard here in order to divide people. Nor do they repeat to these people what they have heard elsewhere in order to divide the people from those. Thus, they are one who reunites those who are divided, a promoter of friendships, who enjoys concord, rejoices in concord, and delights in concord, a speaker of words that promote concord. much malicious speech is to divide people. In other words, you know, that's what gossip sometimes do, to suck up to some people, to be their friends by pointing out the faults in their enemy. They speak abandoning harsh speech. They abstain from harsh speech. They speak such words as are gentle, pleasing to the ear, and lovable, as go to the heart, are courteous, desired by many, and agreeable to many. And abandoning gossip, they abstain from gossip. They speak at the right time, speak of what is fact. Gossip is just like idle speech. It's not really gossip, because gossip is really the malicious speech. This is more like the useless speech. They speak at the right time. What is fact? Speak on what is good. Speak on the Dhamma and the discipline at the right time. They speak such words that are worth recording, reasonable, moderate, and beneficial. And this is as a monk. They abstain from injuring seeds and plants. You don't go around cutting trees. You practice eating only in one part of the day. That's, you know, the morning time. You abstain from eating at night and outside a proper time. You abstain from dancing, singing, music, and theatrical shows. You don't go to the movies. He abstains from wearing garlands, smarting themselves with with scent, and embellishing himself with unguents, so he don't wear aftershave. He abstains from high and large couches. He abstains from accepting gold and silver and money. He abstains from accepting raw grain, from accepting raw meat, accepting women and girls. You don't have slaves and maids. He abstains from accepting men and women slaves. Abstain from accepting goats and sheep. Abstain from accepting fowl and pigs. In other words, in monasteries, not a farm. You abstain from accepting elephants, cattle, horses, and mares. Now remember, that was the means of transport at those times. You abstain from accepting fields and land. You abstain from going on errands and running messages. You abstain from buying and selling. You abstain, in other words, you don't invest all the monastery funds on the stock market. You abstain from false weights, false metals, and false measures. You abstain from cheating, deceiving, defrauding, and trickery. You abstain from wounding, murdering, binding, brigandage, plunderage, and violence. And you become content with the robes to protect your body and with alms food to maintain your stomach. And wherever you go, you set out taking only these with you, the robes and your bowl. Just as a bird, wherever it goes, flies with its wings as its only burden, so too the monk becomes content with the robes to protect their body, with alms food to maintain their stomach, and wherever they go, they set out taking only these with them. So really good monks don't carry suitcases when they go overseas. Possessing this aggregate of noble virtue, they experience with themselves the bliss that is blameless. Now that's, when I got to that point, wow, this is the Anuvajrasukha. It's actually blissful to live so simply. And I know that because sometimes this is when you have such few possessions, and you can go overseas. You know, the last time when I went to Thailand, this is all I took. So it's very easy just to have a few possessions, and then you just breeze through the airports. So nice. And that gives you such a lot of happiness. Sometimes people think that the more possessions you have, just the more pleasure you have. But actually the possessions are a burden, as many of you know. The fewness of possessions makes you very light. It has a blameless happiness. And now we have the sense restraint on seeing a form with the eye. You do not grasp at its signs and features. In other words, you know, sometimes when you see a form, like a beautiful dress in the shop, which you really want, a beautiful girl, sort of, you know, a new iPod, which has just come on the market. Since if you left the eye faculty unguarded, evil, unwholesome states of covetousness, I really want, and grief, but I can't afford it, might invade you. You practice a way of restraint, you guard the eye faculty, undertake restraint of the eye faculty. The same with sounds, smells, touches, and tastes. And on cognizing a mind object, you make sure you restrain that so that you don't get inflamed with wanting. You become one who acts in full awareness when going forward, returning. In other words, with full mindfulness. Full awareness means not just being mindful, but know why you're doing that for. What's the purpose of what you're doing? So when looking and looking away, you act in full awareness when flexing, extending your limbs, when wearing robes, carrying the bowl and robe, when eating, drinking, consuming food, tasting, full awareness when defecating, urinating, when walking, standing, sitting, when sleeping, when waking, when awake, talking and keeping silent. Possessing this aggregate of noble virtue, this noble restraint of the faculties, and possessing this noble mindfulness and full awareness, you resort to a secluded resting place, the forest, the root of a tree, a mountain, a ravine, a hillside cave, a charnel ground, a jungle thicket, an open space, a heap of straw. In other words, that this is what a monk is supposed to do. They're not supposed to hang around people. They're not supposed to, you know, be with everybody and just be working every day. They're supposed to be secluded. That's why I keep on saying a good monastery is a community of hermits. And they come together when there's a meal, when there's a meeting, but then they're off into their huts and just, as I say, resorting to secluded resting places, forest, root of a tree, mountain, a ravine, a hillside cave, a charnel ground, jungle thicket, an open space, a heap of straw, when there's not many people around. And on returning from your arms round after your meal, they sit down, folding the legs crosswise, setting his body erect, and establishing mindfulness as a priority. Abandoning, this is covetous for the world, the first of the hindrances, you abide with a mind free from the first hindrance of covetousness. Abandoning ill will and hatred, you abide with a mind free from ill will and hatred. Compassionate for the welfare of all living beings, you purify your mind from ill will and hatred. Abandoning sloth and torpor, you abide free from sloth and torpor, percipient of light, the brightness in the mind. Mindful and fully aware, you purify your mind from sloth and torpor. Abandoning restlessness and remorse, you abide unagitated, with a mind inwardly peaceful. This is not restful, inwardly peaceful, inwardly. You purify your mind from restlessness and remorse. Abandoning doubt, you abide having gone beyond doubt. Unperplexed about wholesome states, you purify your mind from doubt. Those are the five hindrances. So when you sit down meditation, that's basically what you're doing, abandoning the five hindrances. What happens when the five hindrances are abandoned? Only one thing happens. Having thus abandoned these five hindrances, imperfection of the mind that weaken wisdom, quite secluded from sensual, from the five senses, secluded from unwholesome states, you enter upon and abide in the first jhana, and then the second, and then the third, and then the fourth jhana. Now, usually in the gradual training, you only go as far as the fourth jhana. That's good enough. When your concentrated mind is thus purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfections, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability. In other words, this is what the mind does in these jhanas. It becomes usable. Then you can direct it to knowledge of the recollection of the past lives. So this is actually, you see that reincarnation is a fact. You understand it for yourself. You recollect your manifold past lives. And it's not just the many, many births, but there I was so named, of such a family, with such an appearance, such was my nutriment, such was my experience, such my life term, and passing away from there, I reappeared somewhere else. And this is actually how you understand your previous lives. It's not just some sort of misty sort of maybe, but clearly understanding who you were and what you were doing. And obviously that way you understand the truth of rebirth. And also, when your concentrated mind is thus purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability after the jhanas, you direct it to knowledge of the passing away and reappearance of beings according to karma. With the divine eye, you see beings passing away and reappearing, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate. You are understanding how beings pass on according to their karma. So actually, this is why the Buddha is saying this, because this is actually how you find out the answers to those questions, which was mentioned at the beginning of the sutta. And when your concentrated mind is thus purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, you direct it to knowledge of the destruction of these outflowings of the mind. You understand as it actually is. This is dukkha. This is the origin of suffering. This is the cessation of suffering. And this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. You understand as it actually is. These are the outflowings of the mind, the origin, the cessation, the way leading to the cessation of the outflowings of the mind. And when you know that and see thus, your mind is liberated from sensual desire, liberated from being, and from the taint of ignorance. When it is liberated, there comes the knowledge. It is liberated. You understand. Birth, you might say rebirth, has been destroyed. The holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more to any state of being. This householder is called the kind of person who does not torment themselves or pursue the practice of torturing themselves, and who does not torment others or pursue the practice of torturing others. The one who sins, they torments neither himself nor others, is here and now hungerless, extinguished and cooled, and abides experiencing bliss, having themselves become holy. Now, it's quite clear from that instruction that they're not tormenting themselves by just this beautiful path. I should actually focus on that. Meditating is not tormenting yourself. If you take your meditation, your practice of the Dharma, to be this tough practice, forcing yourself to sit long hours and feeling this pain and sitting through pain, that's tormenting yourself. That's not what the Buddha meant. This is a gentle path. So I kept on saying in the retreat recently in Chiang Rai, quoting from the word of the Buddha, the anthology by Venunyana Taloka, the Buddha said, "Monks, this is a path without groaning. If you're groaning, you miss the path." So it's not tormenting yourself. So if you're tormenting yourself and torturing yourself, you've missed the Buddhist path. That's not the middle way. You won't get the jhanas, you won't get the enlightenment. So it's not tormenting yourself, but it's an interesting that this is not tormenting others either. So what does it mean, not tormenting others? Surely when you're just sitting in the hut meditating all day, you're not doing anything for others. You could be helping others. You could be working to solve the problems of the world. You could be be sort of building up a better retreat center so many more people can come instead of just sitting in your hut meditating all day. Surely you're tormenting others by your inactivity. And of course the Buddha said, no, this is not tormenting others, because just the person who's practicing already gives so much inspiration and encouragement to others. I always remember that when I did my 6 month retreat, when I didn't do anything for anybody at all, just sitting in my hut in Serpentine for 6 months, not talking, not giving any teachings whatsoever, people said it was so inspiring just to know there was a monk who was actually sitting there. You weren't tormenting other people. You were inspiring them. And even more so, a person, man or woman, who follows that gradual training and who just practices and practices to the end. They're not doing nothing. They're actually inspiring, encouraging and helping. Not by words, just by their silence. So this householder is called the person who does not torment himself, nor torment others. When this was said, the Brahmin householders of Sala said to the Blessed One, "Magnificent Master Gotama, Magnificent Master Gotama, Master Gotama has made the Dharma clear in many ways, as though he were turning upright what had been overthrown, revealing what was hidden, showing the way to one who was lost, or holding up a lamp in the darkness for those with eyesight to see forms. We go to the Master Gotama for refuge, and to the Dharma and to the Sangha of monks. From today, let Master Gotama accept us as the lay followers who have gone to him for refuge for life." So that was the Panika Sutta, the incontrovertible teaching. And I must really thank you for sort of not asking too many questions. Either you didn't understand it or you were bored, I'm not quite sure why, but it managed to have this finished in 1.5 hours, which is the whole sutta, is telling all the abbreviations, a very long sutta. And sometimes it's nice to pick the inspiring ones, the ones you like, but I like to give the other ones as well, just so you get a broad understanding of what actually the Buddha taught and what was going on in the time of the Buddha. It gives you a more rounder understanding. You have another question? You're given this by Chegya.
I was going to say, I think you would be happy if you went on.
Very good. Very good. Yes.
Arjun.
Yeah.
With respect to Buddhist cosmology and the destruction by the elements, is there an originality to karma?
In the Buddhist cosmology, in the destruction of the elements, meaning the end of the eon, you mean? Yes, remember, like that karma, if it hasn't got the means to mature, it's actually stored, it's like potential. So when it has the means to actually to come to fruition, then it will come in that particular place. So in other words, If a person is in some heaven realm, because of the good because of the good karma which they have stored up, then any of the bad karma, they can't come up in heaven. It's not the right place to come up, so they have to wait until they fall away from that heavenly rebirth and come to, say, some human realm, and then that unfortunate karma can come to fruition. So at the end of the eon, because there is no karma loka, no sort of material world at that time, that beings have to go into the two other realms, no matter if they like it or not, the rupa loka or arupa loka, the jhana realms or the immaterial realms. That's what the Buddha said. I can understand why that happens. You've got no other place to go. So everybody goes into those jhana realms. So between the eons, until obviously when you come back again, then, you know, your holiday's over, back to work. Just like sometimes when I go overseas, having a wonderful time, just, you know, teaching in a nice resort, and you come back and all the emails and the letters and all the problems are just waiting for you when you come back. So it's like going off to all these retreats. It's like me going off to my heaven realm, sort of between the eons, and the karma can't reach me over in those retreats. But when I come out, then the karma ripens. Okay. Yes, Barbara? Indeed. Well, it's actually saying people who maybe joined the armed forces during the times of peace and they did that for for a livelihood or for, you know, friendship. Maybe they, as people keep saying in the American army, that many people, it's the only way out of the ghettos to get a sort of a life of discipline and a life of respect. And they joined that army in such a way. And then they find themselves in this terrible situation where they're having to kill and mutilate. But I also remember reading a book by a general, and he was saying that one of the most difficult things in training sort of a soldier is actually to get them to actually pull the trigger and shoot. He said it's one of those secrets which, you know, most people don't say, that when it's, you know, life and death, when the enemy is charging towards you and you've got your gun, a huge number of soldiers don't pull the trigger. They'd rather be killed than kill somebody else. And they said that it's, you know, well known, it's one of the, obviously the weaknesses in the army, to get people actually to kill. But they won't do it. And that actually, you know, that actually raised my hope that, you know, if you were in a situation, many people, I'm sure that happened in the Second World, I'm sure that's happened in Iraq, someone's pointing a gun at you and you've got a gun at them, it's me or them, you say, take me. Many people do that. So you always do have that choice. So, Bronwyn, you had a question? Okay, very good. Okay, well, I won't have a retreat for 6 months this evening, but I will have a nice retreat tonight, have a nice quiet time. So thank you for coming and thank you for listening. And now we'll just pay respects to the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha, then we can go and do what we need to do.
Arahaṃ sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādhemi suvākkhato bhagavata dhammo dhammaṃ namassāmi Supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho sanghaṃ namāmi.